Welcome to the Policy Corner podcast. My name is Felix Hoffmann, and I'm here with Dylan and Krekar.
Hi.
Hi.
Today, we will talk the European Union, elections in France, populism, and surely touch upon a range of other topics. To do that, we also have a guest here, Dylan Chambers, who is one of the founders of the Policy Corner. He is currently pursuing his master's degree in political science, and he works at the Global Public Policy Institute, a think tank in Berlin. Welcome, Dylan.
Thanks.
Before we start digging into the many ills and maybe also the newfound hope of the European Union, we want to give you a brief idea of what the Policy Corner is, how you can get involved, and what part this podcast is trying to contribute to the project. So welcome again, Dylan. It's good to have you.
Thanks, good to be here.
So let's start with a short overview over the Policy Corner. What is the general idea?
Okay, so the basic idea of the Policy Corner is that we publish articles online on international topics. The purpose of doing this, I suppose you could say, is twofold. So on the one hand, you have an educational aspect of it. So we are encouraging particularly students and young professionals to get some practical experience in writing articles, learning the style that you need to learn in order to be able to write engaging, persuasive articles that will reach a wider audience, which is a skill that you don't necessarily learn in a standard university education. So that's one aspect of the education, and the other side of that educational component is all of the people involved in the project, so doing the editing and doing the marketing of the project and everything. Because it's student-run, it's an educational experience on that end too. The other big purpose of our website is to encourage debate on pressing international issues and encourage discussion and get some creative ideas, potential solutions.
All right, so there's an educational part, there's the debate part. Yeah. And how many members does the Policy Corner actually have right now, and where are you guys planning on taking the project in the future?
Sure. So we're currently about 21 members. So we have 14 people working in Berlin, 6 people in Paris, and 1 person in Washington, D.C. We're currently all master's students, more or less. We have 1 person that's working, 1 person who's in their bachelor's. Next year, we're planning to get another 6 people involved in the project in Paris through a projet collectif, a team project with Sciences Po. We did this in the past year, and we're going to be doing this again. So this is just basically we are an institutional partner with Sciences Po and run a course in which 6 students get school credit for helping develop the project with us. So that's the short term. We'll be focusing on that. We're looking at organizing an article competition, so getting some fundraising, some cash prizes for the best submitted articles later this year. And in the longer term, we're looking at ramping up the educational component of the project, also through workshops and that sort of thing.
All right, so now that we've heard about sort of the basic idea and where the project stands right now and where is it going, how can people get involved?
Sure, so there are a few clear ways that people can get involved. Of course, anyone and everyone is encouraged to write an article and submit it to us. Once it gets submitted, it goes through an editorial process that can be quite constructive and useful. So I definitely encourage everyone to get involved like that. But we also are always looking for people to help build the project from the inside. So that includes building up our fundraising or partnership space, or perhaps helping get involved in the editorial process. There are a number of different ways. In order to see a little bit it all in a bit more detail, just take a look at our website in the Join Us section.
Exactly. So that's what I wanted to say. The most important part, just to our listeners, check out the website, policycorner.org. You can check out the articles, which are super interesting, and also you can find out how to get involved. And maybe the next question Krekar brought.
I just wanted to ask who can publish articles, and what kind of articles and topics do you cover?
Sure. So on our website we have, so I'll answer the second question first. On the website we have seven different topic areas. They're designed to cover almost all major topics within international affairs and current international debates. If you want to write an article that doesn't fit one of those, just take a look on the website. Just take a look at the topic areas and scroll down. If your topic doesn't fit one of those, get in contact with us, and I'm sure we can work something out. So the idea is actually we're not limiting the topic areas. We really would like people to write about what they're passionate about. And at the moment, we have these seven different topic areas with things like international development and economic policy and so on. And as to the first question, who can get involved in writing articles? Absolutely everyone is the answer. We're targeting particularly master's students, but also bachelor's students, because we know that this is the core group of people that really want to be learning these skills. But anybody, including young professionals or people who are not studying at all, we encourage everyone to get involved.
And what do the articles go through before the final submission? How do you help the young writers and academics?
Sure. So when an article gets submitted, it goes through a number of different steps. The first thing is that it gets it goes through our standard check to see if it meets all of the basic requirements. That is to say that it is around about 900 words long, that it has a short title, that it has a clear policy focus, and that it's not overly academic. So we're, instead of academic style, which would be things like henceforth, therefore, thus, use these sorts of turns of phrase, we are looking for a more journalistic style, something a little bit easier for readers to engage with. So we check for all of those things. If that has that, then it goes into the, I suppose you could say, the more formal editing process. So then it has a peer review stage in which it gets sent out to two of our peer reviewers who specialize in the topic area of the article. They send their peer reviews back to the author, who then has an opportunity to revise their work with constructive feedback.
So let me now give you a short introduction to this project, our podcast project. So first things first, we are students and we have a reasonable amount of work to do, so we will try to do this once a month, but it might not always work out. We, that is my friend Krekar, who studies political science on the master's level, and me, my name is Felix Hoffman. I'm currently in the last semesters of my bachelor's degree in political science as well. The general idea is that in every podcast, we will pick an article from the Policy Corner website, policycorner.org, give you a brief overview over its main argument, and then discuss it with its author. To make it even more interesting and relevant, we will also relate it to sort of current events in world politics. So you can also use this podcast to sort of follow the news. This is, of course, not a static concept, since we're hoping to have a lively debate and we just want to see where it takes us. So let's get back to the task at hand. The article we want to discuss today deals with Europe's splintered union, which is also its title. You can find it on policycorner.org. And Dylan Chambers, who just talked to you about the project in general, is also its author. Welcome again, Dylan. So here's our first question. In your article, you present five theses on why resentment of the European Union is so widespread. Could you give us a short overview over this thesis?
Sure. Okay, so the first thing to note is that right at the outset, I point out that there are three perhaps key standard explanations, right? One is that is often said that there are the losers of globalization and that they're pushing back against the European Union. The second point that's often made is there's a cultural clash between people coming in from outside the EU and people living within the EU and within the different countries, so basically migration. And the third being the democratic deficit, so that the European Union doesn't really function like a democratic governance body. And I'd just like to point out that all three of these explanations are have an important role to play in explaining the rise of Euroscepticism. So the five theses that I point out in my article are supplementary to those three. These five that I point out are, first of all, the economic situation in the European Union. This is something that cannot be ignored. Basically, the correlation between support for the European project and economic situation has been very clear, particularly since 2008, since the global financial crisis and then the subsequent European euro crisis. So this is very important. The second point is that in recent years, the so-called migration crisis, which is to say the influx of refugees from other parts of the world to Europe, the way that it's been dealt with by the European Union has been fragmented and ineffectual. And this has led to a lot of critique and a lot of disillusionment of European citizens. The third point that I'd like to make, or that I make in my article, is that people are feeling increasingly alienated, particularly disconnected, you could also say, from European elites. And the fourth point was that people are not feeling particularly that the people's attachment to Europe as a whole, as opposed to, for example, attachments with their local communities or their national communities, is not strong enough for the majority of people, in order for that to overcome any misgivings they may have about the project. And the fifth point that I make is that increasing disengagement politically in general has been contributing through populism in particular to this trend of Euroscepticism.
All right, so that is a lot of problems.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a lot of problems. So which one of these problems do you think is the most serious one for the EU? Or do you think that it's a combination of all of those, or some of those?
Well, I think that, of course, you can't say that any of these problems exist in isolation from the other. So it's not possible to just focus on one. On the other hand, if I were to highlight one that I think has been particularly harmful to the European project and support for that project, I would say it's the economic crisis since 2008. Like I said, the evidence is really clear that this has really shaken faith in the European project. And it's easy to understand because the economic crisis in particularly southern European countries is not looking much better than it did in 2010. And so it's pretty easy in this sort of situation to lose hope in the ability of this political project to actually find solutions.
I think another important point sort of relating to the European crisis is the growing social injustice inside the European Union. So you have a real disconnect between sort of the northern part of Europe where governments like the government of Germany are sort of following a policy of strict austerity and trying to sort of, sometimes force other governments to cut social benefits, to cut their welfare states. And on the other hand, you have the southern European states that feel sort of treated unfairly. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is sort of part of the problem in a sense that it contributed to the rise of populism that we've seen in recent years?
Sure. I think it's central to the rise of populism in Europe recently, because the way that the politics has been spun is that actually both people in the relatively richer north in Europe, in Germany, for example, and in the relatively poorer south, so in Greece, for example, they both feel victimized, and politicians have scapegoated each other on both sides, and this obviously is not conducive to integration.
Politicians also scapegoated the EU, which is
right.
A very common
right.
means to sort of deflect blame.
Yeah.
That leads me to sort of my next question, which is goes more to the basis. So we talk a lot about populism. It's being mentioned over and over again in the media. Mm-hmm. It tends to be used to sort of delegitimize political enemies.
Sure.
So everyone's always really fast at screaming populism as soon as you don't like a position. So what do you think is populism? Is it an ideology? Is it a political strategy? Is it a way of communicating? Or is it something else completely?
Yeah, well, I think that to understand what populism is, we need to look at where it came from. So the term actually was born with the populist movement in the United States, which was founded in 1891. And back then, it was basically a farmers' movement, an alliance against established elites in city centers. The fundamental thing here was it was the people, so the popular power, rising up against the established elites away in their rich privileged city centers, who were having political policies which favored people, particularly business and financial elites in those city centers. If we now look at how populism and the word is used today, we see some important similarities. The key similarities being that today the word is almost always used when it is a political, either a politician or a movement which claims to be anti-elitist and anti-establishment. So it's actually, I think fundamentally, populism is built on dislike or even hatred for whatever is the established elite, and then presenting an alternative. Now, that means that populism can manifest in many different ways, because it depends very much on what is perceived to be the elite, what is perceived to be the political establishment, and what is popular opinion in any particular place.
I think what's also really interesting about populism is that it can go sort of right and left.
Right.
So I think there was a political scientist, I think it was Laclau, who sort of introduced the idea of populism as a thin ideology that sort of has to stick to a different sort of ideology, which can be something on the left, like socialism. Then you have, for example, a leftist populism party like Podemos in Spain, and it can go all the way to the right, for example, Front National in France, which takes me to my next question. So populists, at least in like the last half year, seems like they're kind of losing steam. So they've lost elections in Austria, they've lost elections in the Netherlands, in France most recently. Do you think the populist threat to Europe is over? Can we just rest easy?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think the clearest example that the populist threat, if you like to put it that way, is not over, is if you look at Italy, in the coming year, they're likely to have a national election, and it seems increasingly likely that Beppe Grillo, the leader of the Five Star Movement, that he seems to have a real chance of being elected. Now, this politician, he has stated that he is for breaking up the euro, for example. Now, this is something that clearly is counter to the European project, and could have all sorts of unforeseen negative ramifications. So this is just one example. I think the other key example that the threat is not over is that if you look at France, although Macron was not elected, it's important to remember that almost a quarter of the French people did vote for Le Pen, something that would have only a number of years ago would have seemed impossible.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree. So the big question, maybe to sort of take it forward, do you think that sort of all of these problems, but right now it seems like, you know, the European Union has sort of bought some time. Do you think that this sort of dramatic moment can be turned into a moment of constructive renewal for the EU? And before you answer, I want to point to something that happened recently, which was the G7 summit, where Trump sort of, trumped out, mm-hmm. and And then the talk that German Chancellor Angela Merkel gave in a beer tent, which was very much discussed in media all over the world. Let's just listen to her.
Wir Europäer müssen unser Schicksal wirklich in unsere eigene Hand nehmen. Natürlich in Freundschaft mit den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika, in Freundschaft mit Großbritannien, in guter Nachbarschaft, wo immer das geht, auch mit Russland, auch mit anderen Ländern. Aber wir müssen wissen, wir müssen selber für unsere Zukunft kämpfen, als Europäer, für unser Schicksal. Und das will ich gerne mit Ihnen gemeinsam tun.
So what the German Chancellor basically is saying is that we need to take our fate into our own hands as Europeans. We need to do it in friendship, of course, with the Americans and the United Kingdom, also with Russia and other countries in good neighborhood. And we need to fight for our future and fate as Europeans. So the question that this sort of raises is the question I've raised before, namely, is there a moment of new dynamic for the European Union?
Hmm. Well, it certainly does seem like things are changing, and there are some positive developments. Macron's willingness, for example, to re-engage a dialogue about reforming the EU and the Eurozone is very welcome indeed. And I suppose, interestingly, the election of Trump may actually, as we can see from this quote, may actually serve to galvanize Europeans to create more of a common united stance or united identity, which could be beneficial towards the European project. Yeah.
So you just brought up Macron, which I think is a really interesting topic right now, because Macron is actually looking at huge challenges. He basically just founded his party out of nothing. They don't have any structures. They're not well organized yet, and they have parliamentary elections coming up. And he needs a majority to sort of govern. So he's looking at huge challenges. What do you think happens if he fails? What happens to the European Union?
Yeah. Well, of course, no one really knows. But if he fails, and it's unfortunately is a good chance that he will, given the challenges that he's facing. If he fails, then it seems almost certain that popularity for Front National will grow. Whether it'll grow enough for them to win the next national election, no one can tell, but it's certainly a risk. Now, if that does happen, then it could mean the disintegration of the entire European project, or could mean the beginning of that. I mean, at the very least, it could mean the disintegration of the euro.
All right. So what do you think should be the European Union's response to this danger? What can states like Germany, that are very strong economically, what can they do to sort of support Macron and keep that from happening?
I think, so if we look at the key points that I mentioned earlier on, I think that, of course, the most important thing is to solve this euro crisis. Now, that's a much more complex issue than that we have space for discussing in depth in this podcast. But there are a few steps that have been recognized by most economists as being essential. Some sort of real banking union, for example, is often mentioned as a necessary step. Macron has taken the novel step of actually suggesting there be a finance minister for the Eurozone, which is, in my opinion, a very sensible suggestion, will be, on the other hand, a very difficult one politically to implement, and a number of other things. There are a lot of other things that Merkel could be doing, but for the sake of brevity, I would say that's where she needs to focus.
So, the answer seems to be continued European integration. So, do you think that overall, all of the things we have discussed, did the European Union just buy some time? And also, do you think that there are better chances for true reform in the European Union now, sort of with the threat of the failure of the Macron presidency and then maybe Le Pen presidency coming up, sort of dangling over everyone's head?
Well, so you've said, have the Europeans just bought themselves some time? And I would sort of think of it differently. I would say, rather than having bought themselves time, they have suddenly, well, many people have suddenly woken up to the fact that they're running out of time. And Europe has been running out of time for quite some time. So it's becoming more urgent now. Whether that urgency is enough to really spur political leaders into action, and perhaps even more importantly, private citizens into urging their political leaders to take action, that I'm not sure, but I certainly hope so.
All right. So it is up to us. It is up to you. Go pressure your representatives. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you liked it. We'd very much appreciate your feedback. You can just email us at any policycorner.org website email address you find on our website. Thank you, Dylan.
Sure.
Thank you, Kirkar.
Pleasure.
It was a good time. And my name is Felix Hoffmann, and I'll see you, listen to you, speak to you next month.